The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, where we get to know the stories of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion and hard work have changed lives, society, and even the world in all kinds of ways. I'm Mojo Abidi. I'm a journalist and the presenter of this very special podcast. And today I'm here with Julie Siddiqui. Julie is someone who finds it impossible to stay silent when she sees injustice happening. She's a Muslim convert, a campaigner, and a women's rights activist, with a list of accomplishments so long it would take a whole episode just to go through them all. Among them are the Open My Mosque campaign, which fights inequality in UK mosques, and Together We Thrive, an organisation that connects Muslim women to people of all backgrounds. But I'll let her tell you more about those and the issues that spark her fighting spirit. Julie, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast. I'm delighted you're here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to be here.
Julie, one thing I know about you is that you're not scared to speak about difficult topics or call out things people don't want you to call out. You've kind of made a career out of it.
It's not something I necessarily looked for. And when I look back, I think, wow, if someone had told me in my kind of early 20s that I'd be doing this kind of stuff, I would not have believed them. I had no confidence. I couldn't speak even in front of kind of three people in those days. And I've just been on a journey, I guess. It's been about time, figuring out myself, what I feel strongly about. I think intentions are really important. And certainly from a faith perspective for me, having good intentions for things is a really key thing. I think the other thing I think about, you say about injustice, but of course there's so much injustice in the world that sometimes it can actually feel quite overwhelming. And I think one thing I feel quite important is to pick your battles, I guess, or just, you know, you can't do it all. So I think it's just really important to find your thing and focus on that. And to know yourself is probably one of the most important things as to why you're doing any of these things. Because what happens is if you're then questioned about why you're doing it or challenged or, you know, there's negativity or whatever, it makes it much easier to kind of justify even in your own head then.
Calling out injustice is not an easy thing to do. It's difficult. Where do you find that strength?
I guess it goes back to what I said about understanding myself and knowing what I feel strongly about. If I have the confidence or if I feel strongly about something, chances are there are many people who agree with me on the issues, but they don't feel they can do any of those things. So I think, you know, I feel like I can be a voice on certain things, and so I should. It's almost a, you know, it becomes an obligation. I certainly feel as I've got older, I'm 50 now, and I feel like, you know, there are younger people who can do things better and differently to me. But there are also younger people who wouldn't have the confidence in the same way that I have, because I've developed the thick skin that one has to develop in communities and trying to, you know, tackle some of these issues. So that thick skin is serving me well now. And if you think about something like Me Too, which is a huge movement, which we've seen, you know, really kind of take off in the most amazing way in the last couple of years, I think has given women in particular more of a sense that actually we're kind of onto something here, that all of us can sort of join hands, even if we may not agree on everything, we can join up and use that, you know, the momentum of that to speak up or speak out or challenge or say, you know what, enough is enough, I'm not going to keep quiet anymore. I definitely think that has all helped as well.
You've talked about finding your thing and picking your battles. How did you pick your battles? How do you pick the things you choose to speak out against?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, look, sometimes or often it will be a natural process. I think for me, certainly some of the things I'm focusing on in a Muslim community kind of setting, I think it's partly also to do with time and realizing that, look, who is actually going to call this stuff out and who's going to make that next leap? You know, sometimes you need a person or a group of people to kind of make the next leap that feels big, but it actually is what will then spark the other smaller actions or what will change people's perception. So I think it's been a natural thing for me. I haven't gone looking really for any of this stuff. So I think it's a constant process as well, a constant kind of rebalancing and feeling, if you feel really strongly about something, is there something you can do? Is there one thing you can change? You know, try and keep it small, but also what are your skills? What are you good at? You know, I'm not good at everything. A lot of what I've done, there's no money in it, you know, certainly not about money. And so it has to be motivated through other things. And so if you feel there's something you feel strong about, don't always imagine that other people are going to do something about it. It can also be you as well. That's kind of how I've always seen it.
You've said before that you think Muslim women are some of the most misunderstood people in the world. I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I've often said, you know, the most misunderstood, the most talked about, talked at, talked over group on the planet, probably. And I think it's come really from seeing everyone from kind of Boris Johnson to Muslim men to people in the newspapers. You know, if there's anything that I think is misunderstood about Islam as a faith itself, is about the perceptions that people have of women and what Islam has to say about women. And of course, a lot of that has come from stereotypes and misconceptions and horrible newspaper articles, and it's really unhelpful. Now, having said all of that, some of it is also based on a reality. You know, if people look to a country and see that within the laws of that country, women are not allowed to drive, for example, that just doesn't make sense to most people, perhaps. And if you see oppression of women and it's done in the name of Islam, in our case, then of course it's very hard to understand how on earth is this all working? You know, why would someone like me, for example, choose to be a Muslim of my own choosing for so many years and be very happy and content in my faith and connection with God, while at the same time you've got all of this oppression? It kind of doesn't make sense. Well, of course, if you stop and think about that, it will make you realize that actually the way it's spoken about or understood is perhaps not fully how it actually is, despite the fact that, as I say, there are injustices and misconceptions done in the name of Islam. Of course, even things around terrorism, you know, very, very difficult topics. But I think we're at the point where many Muslim women like me in countries like this and elsewhere are saying, okay, you know, and have always said, but I think there's more and more saying, right, we can talk for ourselves. Don't patronize us either. You know, don't kind of think that you have to speak on our behalf necessarily about the kinds of issues we've already mentioned, but we can do it for ourselves. We're coming together. You know, I see many more Muslim women kind of banding together with each other now to create that movement and that conversation and that challenge. I met an amazing young woman actually last night who's only 24 and went through, you know, the most horrendous violent marriage, and her approach to it now and how she has moved through and is now wanting to speak about it, even though it's very difficult for the sake of others. You know, for me, people like that are just amazing. But of course we need each other, because these things are hard as well. So I think it's I would say to anybody listening to this who has those same misconceptions and stereotypes, just really stop and think about that and try and think, what can you do about it? And the most important and, I guess, powerful way, of course, are to meet real people, right? Don't just rely on the newspapers and the horrible things you might see on the internet. Try and reach out and meet Muslim women in our case and have those conversations. And in most cases, you'll very, very quickly realize, oh, okay, it's not quite what some of these newspapers and others would have us believe. You know, there's something, I guess, threatening and frightening about women who, for example, I mean, I wear a headscarf. Many, many Muslim women don't. Some do. You know, there's a whole mix of, we're like warts and all of its diversity. But let me decide that, you know, whether I want to wear it or not. Don't kind of be saying that, you know, women have the right to wear whatever they want, but not really Muslim women. And I think that whole issue around equality, gender or inequality, is a conversation that women and men, I guess, but in our case, women need to have much more together, you know, across the board, without sitting in silos. And of course, it's so easy to divide people for other people to do that and, you know, pitch people against each other. And you need to move away from that as well, I think, as best as we can.
That brings us really nicely to your network called Together We Thrive, which is about Muslim women not only working together, but within wider society. What a perfect name, Together We Thrive.
Yeah, I mean, look, I love the word thrive. And of course, the words are all important. Together we thrive. And it's so true, you know, whenever we get our act together, whatever that is, and do stuff together, we're much more likely to be better and thrive. You know, I've done a lot of work with people from different backgrounds, particularly faith communities, and I love it. I particularly love working with women from different faiths who also, like me and other Muslim women, are challenging the stuff, the patriarchal stuff, or the misuse of texts, or, you know, how things are perceived in a certain way through the eyes of men or whatever. When you come across women who are really firm or really passionate about their faith, but also will challenge that stuff, I absolutely love that, probably the most of all, because, you know, we're not going anywhere. You don't tell me that I need to not be Muslim or not be Jewish or to, you know, for Catholic women. You know, there's a lot of conversations within some Catholic circles among women challenging some of the things that, you know, others just sort of presume are how they are, and that you can't challenge that stuff and still be a faithful Catholic, you know, or whatever. I love that stuff. So for me, Thrive, or Together We Thrive, is also about a lot of that as well. And then, of course, there are men. You know, I always say I love men as long as they're the right kind of men. And I'm very happily married to a lovely man, also find very frustrating at times. And, you know, when it comes to a lot of the things that I focus on, whether it be Muslim specific stuff or generally in society around inequality and things, particularly around gender, you know, men haven't done enough and sit on that kind of, I guess, privilege because it doesn't affect them. There's no pain. You know, if a man wants to go and pray in a mosque, he pretty much can. It's very rare for anybody to tell him that he can't come in, and certainly not in an aggressive way that we have seen as women. So I think there's that as well. And I just try and get people like him to reflect on it. But I think there's definitely a role for men as well. There always is. Of course, those male allies can be and are really, really important and can do so much if they just realize that they can use their voice to challenge stuff in a way that we actually can't. So I think it's both, but I just think it's not, for me, it's not an anti-men thing, but that, you know, that we do need to call that out when we see it as well, I think.
You talked a little bit there about men never being turned away from mosques, and you run a campaign called Open My Mosque. Could you tell us about the work you do through that?
Yeah, so I mean, look, we started it really, it's, as I said, it comes from I guess, like I was saying earlier, long time of seeing not much changing. And we also did it, in all honesty, on the back of a campaign which is positive called Visit My Mosque, which is about encouraging more people to come into mosques. You know, people have this, again, going back to the stereotypes and misconception stuff, you know, people think they know or worry about or scared about what's going on in mosques. And it's quite bizarre when you hear people's impressions of that. It's sad, actually, because they're just usually very ordinary or actually very lovely places. A lot of people go into a mosque maybe abroad but have never ever been in one here. So the idea of having a day or a focus on inviting people in is a great thing, no doubt. But some of us as Muslim women kind of felt it's a bit ironic because there are many mosques. I mean, no one actually has the figures. It's quite hard to pin it down, but there are probably about 1,500 mosques in Britain. Some are small, some are bigger, in different parts of the country. And we think at least a third, maybe more of those don't even have a space for women to pray in. And they get around the law and all of that. But it's really not okay at all. And, you know, when you're on the receiving end of it, it actually can be one of the worst feelings of all, because you're going to your own place of worship and then told in sometimes a very aggressive way you can't come in. And sometimes it might be the caretaker or another person telling you. But just the way they sometimes do it is horrible. And so we kind of tongue-in-cheek called it Open My Mosque on the back of that, what is a positive but needs a challenge, Visit My Mosque campaign. And what we have done is collected the stories. You know, stories are powerful. You can't argue with people's stories. Collected those, and we've recently done a survey, you know, questionnaire. We've got about 300 people that have filled that in from all over the country, different ages. And a lot of the experiences are very disappointing, very sad. Yes, we've got some good stuff as well. We always say that we kind of talk about the good, the bad, and the really bad, or the ugly. And also we're looking at the legal aspects of this, because clearly, you know, if I was to go to a, say, a pet shop right now, and was told aggressively or whatever at the door, you can't come in because you're a woman or a Muslim or both, there'd be uproar. In fact, many people, Muslims, men, I would say, would be outside that pet shop saying the CEO needs to resign. Where's the government? It's Islamophobic. You know, why are you stopping our Muslim sister from coming in the pet shop, you know, in this case? But of course, when it happens in a mosque, no one conveniently says anything. Everyone just conveniently goes quiet and pretends like it's not happening. And legally, it just doesn't feel right. So at the moment, there are, if you like, kind of loopholes or areas where it's grey and they get away with it in that way. Because actually, from an equality point of view, in Britain in 2022, it just doesn't feel right. And, you know, it's difficult to talk about this stuff publicly, right? Because it's like calling out your own in a way, if you see it in that way. But we have to. And, you know, I've definitely seen how when it's more public, it's uncomfortable for people. But just open the doors and let people in, you know, make people feel welcome. That's really what we're saying, I guess, in what we're trying to do.
And it's important because when mosques get it right, it can be amazing. I'm half Pakistani, so half of my family is Muslim. And this summer, we lost my gran from that side of the family, which was really hard. We were really close. And I'm not particularly religious, but she had quite a traditional funeral. And I was involved with quite a lot of it. So I did things like the washing of the body. I can't remember what that's called.
Ghusl. Ghusl.
That's it. And we had the funeral in a mosque. And I was actually quite nervous about it because I haven't spent a lot of time in mosques and I'm not particularly religious and I didn't really know how I'd be received. But I was really welcomed. Everyone was very loving and kind. And yeah, as you say, like I almost felt at home and it was such a lovely experience that it really changed my perspective a little bit. And I would definitely go back there. So when they get it right, it can be amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm so sorry to hear about your grandmother, but also I think the, you know, the process when that kind of thing is done well can literally make the difference. You feel held and you feel part of something. And I think, you know, quite often mosques actually do, let me say, death well in that sense, which is a lovely thing. And it can make all the difference. And it's interesting because sometimes the way they are at other times sometimes can be a bit more relaxed when someone passes away and other people in the family. And even, you know, of course, nowadays people have got friends from all backgrounds. People might be married into a family that isn't Muslim or have wider relatives or whatever. And it's really, really important to make people feel part of something at those times, because that community, which we all want, we all need a community of some type, whether we like to admit it or not, not just even religious people, but anybody. And so to feel that, and it's really lovely to hear that you had a good experience. And those are the things I mean, you know, we need to champion and tell people how it feels for someone to be made welcome, just as we need to say how it feels when we're not made to feel welcome. And it's not right and it's not fair. And it's so disappointing and so upsetting. You know, I've been in situations myself where you feel like I've even cried before. It's like, I just want to pray. And you're making it so difficult for me. It's not fair. It's not right.
You talked about how upsetting it was when you said, you know, the doors are literally closed in your face. You helped two women who were thrown out of an Islamic centre in London, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, because I, you know, people send me stuff all the time. So someone sent me a video that had been put on Instagram about two young Muslim women who were literally, there were four of them out for a meal in central London and they wanted to pray. I mean, how brilliant and beautiful is that in these days of people not really praying, right? So that's amazing. They left two of them at the restaurant with the bags. Two of them went to pray and then they were going to swap. And when they went, they were, you know, forced physically, kind of, you know, told they couldn't come in. And they were, you know, they were, the door was literally closed on them. Because they're young, younger than me, they thought of filming it straight away. So they filmed it. You got this footage of what you can tell is very aggressive behavior against them. They put it online and someone sent it to me and I then tracked them down. And they had written to and were writing to all kind of big Muslim organizations and others, and nobody was getting back to them because people just, as I said earlier, they don't want to talk about the difficult stuff. It's hard. And you just almost like want to pretend like it's not happening. But for them, it was a really big thing, and it was quite, you know, quite that they were quite shaken by it, as you would be, and quite surprised and disappointed, and all the things that I've said, frustrated and angry and let down, and all the emotions were there. So I, you know, we worked with them, and there's a group of us that have, as I say, talking a lot about these issues. So we kind of brought them in, you know, put our arms around them collectively. And many of us are older, right? People who've been through this stuff a lot and feel very passionate about it. And here we were, as a group of older women in most cases, nurturing, I guess, these younger women who needed support, were very passionate about it, but really didn't feel they had the confidence to kind of do anything, and they didn't want to do. So we worked with them, and you know, for me, it was important that it was their story. So I very quickly thought to myself, I think we need to do a moment or something physical or in public. And again, it's not really me always. I don't always look for confrontation or kind of public stuff. It's not really me at all. And I know a lot of people cringe at that stuff as well. So even when I suggested it to our group, including with these two young women, some of the women were like, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know. It's a bit out there. It's a bit much. And I get it, you know, I understand. And you know, they will get backlash from family. They might get it from their own, you know, their own mosque perhaps, or whatever. But anyway, a number of us who did feel comfortable enough, including two of the young women, we did do it. You know, we had a moment. We did a pray-in, you could say, outside, like the people do sit in. We did a pray-in outside the mosque in Soho, in the middle of central London, and it was a symbolic prayer that we did outside the mosque together as women. It was powerful, you know. Many of us had tears in our eyes, me included, at the time that we stood to pray. It was kind of a, gosh, this is quite a big thing. Like, we deliberately didn't put a public event on Facebook or anything like that. We did it just as a small group because it only needed to be symbolic, but it was powerful. And you know, people, you know, we filmed bits of it and talked about it and put photos online. And I had messages from people, including men actually, saying, look, I admit I haven't done enough, and you know, what can I do more of? And I'm not expecting miracles, and some of those men haven't come back to me since then. But do you know what? It's in there, it's lodged, it's public, it's physical, it's visible. It was really, really quite something. So there were lo and then loads of interaction with the public, of course, and people off, and also people just ignoring us because it's fine, and you could just pray wherever, and this is London, and we should be able to do it.
That's amazing. It's such a powerful image of you all praying together outside. You mentioned the reaction from the public, but what about the mosque itself? Did they ever respond?
Yeah, I mean, look, we tried to connect with them through various contacts, and I think what I would say, and this happened at another mosque in London as well, around the same sort of time, actually, very, very, you know, horrible experience of a group of women going to another mosque in London, and just the whole experience. We were supposed to be taking women there. Some were Muslim, some not. I mean, for the Muslim women, that was just horrible. You know, the way we were treated, the way we made to feel, the way the lead, the place that led us to the place we needed to pray. So again, in both cases, actually, you know, trying to then interact with the trustees of the place, you know, you'll end up with people who are just completely set in their ways. Often older men, but not always. You will get younger men who keep that line going as well. But certainly in this case, it was harder. Their, you know, line is always about space, you know. So we've had some engagement with them, but it's not always been easy. But I think the fact that we've put it on the map, as it were, is also means that other people can then also challenge them. And you know, it's like an ongoing process. And the place in the other part of London, in East London, where I wrote to them officially to say, look, this is not really good enough, and you're going to need to do something about it. And we're talking to the Charity Commission and, you know, different legal people and all of that. And actually, I had a call from one of the younger trustees to say to me in that case that no one had ever made him understand what it was like from our perspective. Like, he did what I said earlier, that kind of privileged thing where he's always okay to pray, never actually walked in our shoes. And someone said to me recently, and this was a few months back, that I ended up having that conversation with him, and he definitely then took it back to the trustees. And someone sent us a tweet recently from that mosque to say that it was much better, the way they had changed the way women go in, and the whole, you know, setup was different and better. And I thought to myself, you know, you never know where that comes from. But I like to think that some of our pushing on that, and specifically writing to them and all of that, I think that did definitely play some part in some of that. whether people like to admit that or not, I don't really care. It's not about, you know, any of that. It's just about the change, right? And then just to add really quickly, you know, the idea that there are very few mosque boards that have any women on them at all. And of course, as we know in society in general, in every single incident that you can think of in every setting, whether it be boardrooms or schools or wherever, right? Anything, any organization, having diversity on the boards for decision making is really important. And let's just be clear, this is not a mosque issue now I'm talking about. This is across the society. You know, I was in a conversation recently with the England Cricket Board about their boards, right? And their structures. And if you look at companies, and yes, we've made progress, but there are still so many companies or so many local authorities that are, you know, let's say white and male, for example. You know, that this isn't a specifically Muslim community mosque issue at all when it comes to gender inequality or inequality across different things, disability or other race or other things, ethnicities. Decision makers being diverse is just important, like full stop.
Julie, we've spoken a lot about different issues and injustices today. I want to ask you how you think society can work towards fixing some of those issues. You do a lot of work with interfaith relations. How important is it for different faith groups and communities to work together to solve some of the big issues we as a society face?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I love faith and religion, and I think it gets a bad press in this country, as it were. There's less people that feel that they're connected to religion. People feel that religions cause wars and all of those conversations. And I'd like to think that as people of faith, with all of our warts and all, and all of our diversity within all of that, that we can and are really making a positive impact on society. If I think about COVID, I think anybody who's honest will know and think and realize that faith groups played a huge role during COVID when it came to literally, I think, saving lives, quite frankly. Stepped up, fed people, did stuff that no one else was doing. So I think faith itself has a positive role to play in society. And I think that often church groups or, you know, other faith groups often don't do stuff enough together. So I think there's still loads of scope. There's loads of great examples. Those of us in that world can point to lots of examples where people are doing things together. But I think there's still so much more.
Julie, I've loved talking to you, but we are nearing the end. Before you go, I'm going to ask you our four quickfire questions that we're going to be asking all our podcast guests. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Can you name a woman who's inspired you?
Gosh, okay. So the first person that comes to mind is Serena Williams. She's amazing. But I also want to mention another one, that the woman I referred to earlier, the young Muslim woman who's been through such a horrendous time of domestic violence, has remarried, is honestly one of the most amazing young women. She's only 24 that I've met in a long time, who's just got such a good spirit about her. So I want to name her and Serena Williams. I'm going to take two.
Oh, that's lovely. I have to get her to listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I guess I will now. Yeah.
What's one piece of advice you'd give your younger self?
Yeah, gosh, I think it would be to warn myself that the difficult stuff and the mistakes are going to be the things that you learn the most from. And I think we all hate that thought of mistakes, and we all hate the thought of being through difficult things. But I think those are the places where we learn whether we like it or not. And I can see many examples in my life now of where that has been the case, where at the time I've hated it. And then you learn from it, you develop your thick skin and you get your resilience. So I think I'd say to my younger self, just be ready. The difficult, horrible things and the mistakes, the bumps in the road, they're going to be the places that actually you learn the most.
Love that. What's the one thing you can't live without?
Yogurt and honey. I have absolutely developed an absolute love, almost obsession, with just plain yogurt and honey, both or together. So I'm going to say yogurt and honey. If I can have yogurt and honey to eat without having anything else, I think I'd be happy forever.
Right, last one. What's one thing about you that would surprise people?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that I've once had the most amazing experience driving a transit van. And I was doing a project with women and we had to transport a load of stuff. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to hire a transit van and do it all in one go. And I absolutely love driving that van. There's something about being high up on the motorway. I was driving it on my own. I had my arm out the window, you know, like that typical kind of view. And I always remember that every time I stopped somewhere like a garage or a petrol station, I just automatically became part of the, if you like, the white van man kind of gang.
Oh, that's brilliant. I think I'd be really scared driving one of those. Julie, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been so wonderful having you on the show.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a really lovely.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. They're the financial partner to the businesses, founders, and investors shaping the innovation economy. The bank for the driven, bold, unstoppable visionaries like you, using technology to make our world better. Learn more at svb.com/UK.